he'd tied him to the bed, only lifting the twisted cloth from time to time as he'd commanded him to speak. And it seemed to me, as I watched Modena puff at the cigarette, that his smooth, unblemished mouth was the worst and most terrible wound of them all. We smoked the beedies down to stubs in silence, and my eyes adjusted to the darkness. I became aware gradually of how small he was, how much smaller he'd become with the shriveling effect of the wounds on his left side. I felt that I was towering over him. I stepped back a pace into the light, picked up my bag, and wagged my head encouragingly. "Garam chai pio?" I asked. "Shall we drink hot tea?" "Dikai," he replied. "Okay." I led the way back through the converted lane and into a chai shop where workers from a local flour mill and bakery were resting between shifts. The men, several of them, shuffled along the wooden bench to make room for us. They were powdered with white flour in their hair and over the whole of their bodies. They looked like phantoms or so many stone statues come to life. Their eyes, no doubt irritated by the dusty flour, were as red as coals from the fiery pit beneath their ovens. Their wet lips where they sipped the tea were black leeches against the ghostly white of their skins. They stared at us with the usual frank Indian curiosity, but looked away quickly when Modena raised his gaping eyes to them.
"I'm sorry for running away," he said quietly,
his eyes fixed on his hands as they fidgeted in his lap. I waited for him to say something more, but he locked his mouth in a tight little grimace and breathed loudly, evenly, through his wide, flaring nose.
Are you okay?"
I asked, when the tea arrived.
"Jarur,"
he answered, with a little smile.
"Certainly."
"Are you okay?"
I thought he was being facetious, and I didn't hide the irritation in my frown.
"I do not mean to offend you," he said, smiling again.
It was a strange smile, so perfect in the curve of the mouth, and so deformed in the stiffened cheeks that dragged the lower lids of his eyes down into little wells of misery.
"I am only offering my help if you need it. I have money. I always carry 10,000 rupees with me."
"What?"
"I always carry..."
Yes, I heard you." He was speaking softly, but still I glanced up at the bakery men to see if they'd heard him as well. "Why were you watching me today in the market?"
"I watch you very often, almost every day. I watch you and Carla and Lisa and Vikram."
"Why?"
"I must watch you. It is one of the ways I will know how to find her."
"To find who?"
"Ulla. When she returns. She won't know where I am. I don't go to Leopold's anymore, or any of the other places we used to be together. When she looks for me, she will come to you or to one of the others, and I will see her, and we will be together."
He made the little speech so calmly, and then sipped at his tea with such contented abstraction, that it exaggerated the weirdness of his delusion. How could he think that Ulla, who'd left him on the bloody bed to die, would return from Germany to be with him? And even if she were to return, how could she react to his face, deformed into that mourner's mask, with anything but horror?
"Ulla went to Germany, Modena."
"I know," he smiled. "I am glad for her.
She won't be coming back."
"Oh, yes," he said flatly. "She'll come back. She loves me. She'll come back for me."
"Why?"
I began, and then abandoned the thought. How do you live?
I have a job. A good job. It pays good money. I work with a friend, Ramesh. I met him when, after I was hurt. He looked after me. At the houses of the rich, when a son is born, we go there, and I put on my special clothes. I put on my costume.
The dire emphasis he'd put on the last word, and the fractured little smile that accompanied it, sent a creeping unease along the skin of my arms. Some of that disquiet croaked into my voice as I repeated the word. Costume.
Yes. It has a long tail and sharp ears, and a chain of little skulls around the neck. I make it that I am a demon, an evil spirit. And Ramesh, he makes that he is a holy sadhu, looking like a holy man, and he beats me away from the house. And I come back, and I make it that I am trying to steal the baby. And the women scream when I come near the baby. And Ramesh, he beats me away again. Again I come back, and again he beats me, until, at the very last, he beats me so badly that I make like I am dying, and I run away. The people pay us good money for the show.
I never heard of it before.
No. It is our own idea, Ramesh and me. But after the first rich family paid us, all the others wanted to be sure to beat the evil spirit away from their new baby son. And they pay us good money, all of them. I have an apartment. I don't own it, of course. But I have paid more than a year of rent in advance already. It is small, but it is comfortable. It will be a good place for Ular and me to live together. You can see the waves of the sea from the main window. My Ulla, she loves the sea. She always wanted a house near to the sea.
I stared at him, fascinated no less by the fact of his speech than its meaning. Modena had been one of the most taciturn men I'd ever known. When we'd both been regulars at Leopold's, he'd gone for weeks at a time, and sometimes as long as a month, without uttering a word in my presence. But the new Modena, the scarred survivor, was a talker. I'd been forced to run him down in a blind alley to get him to talk at all, it was true. But once he started, he became disconcertingly chatty. As I listened to him, as I reoriented myself to the disfigured, voluble version of the man, I became aware of the melodies that his Spanish accent made as it moved fluently between Hindi and English, mixing the two seamlessly and incorporating words from each into a hybrid language that was his own. Adrift on the softness in his voice, I asked myself if that was the key to the mysterious bond that had existed between them, Ulla and Modena. If they'd talked to one another for hours when they were alone, and if that tender euphony, that voice music, had held them together. And then, with a suddenness that caught me off guard, the meeting with Modena was over. He stood to pay the bill and walked out into the lane, waiting for me just beyond the doorway. "I must go," he said, looking nervously to his left and right before raising his wounded eyes to mine.
"Ramesh is there by now, outside the President Hotel. When she comes back, Ulla will be there. She will stay there. She loves that hotel. It is her favorite. She loves the Back Bay area. And there was a plane this morning from Germany, a Lufthansa plane. She might be there."
"You check after every flight?"
"Yes. I do not go in," he murmured,
lifting his hand as if to touch his face, but running it through his short, graying hair instead.
"Ramesh goes in the hotel for me. He checks her name, Ulla Falkenberg, to see if she is there. One day she will be there. She will be there."
He began to walk away from me, but I stopped him with a hand on his shoulder. "Listen, Modena, Don't run away from me next time, okay? If you need anything, if there's anything I can do, just ask me. Is it a deal?
I will not run away again, he said solemnly. It is just my habit to run. And it was just my habit that was running away from you. It was not me running, just my habit. I am not afraid of you. You are my friend.
He turned to leave, but I stopped him again, drawing him closer to me so that I could whisper into his ear. Medina, don't tell anyone else that you keep so much money on you. Promise me.
Nobody else knows that, Lean, he assured me,
smiling that deep-eyed grimace at me.
Only you. I would not say that to anyone. Not even Ramesh knows that I have money with me. He does not know that I save my money. He does not even know about my apartment. He thinks that I spend my share of the money that we earn together on drugs. And I do not take any drugs, Lean. You know that. I never did any drugs. I just let him think that I do. But you are different, Lin. You are my friend. I can tell you the truth. I can trust you. Why should I not trust the man who killed the devil himself?
What do you mean?
I'm talking about Maurizio, the enemy of my blood.
I didn't kill Maurizio, I said, frowning down into the red-walled caves of his eyes. His perfect mouth widened into an accomplice's leer. The expression dragged harder on the Y-shaped scars that were once the lower lids of his eyes. The gape of those eyes was so unnerving in the flame-lit lane that I had to steel myself not to flinch or draw back when he reached out to put his palm on my chest.
Do not worry, Lean. The secret is safe with me. I am glad that you killed him. Not just for me. I knew him. I was his best friend. His only friend. If he lived, after he did this to me, there was no limit to his evil. That is how a man destroys his own soul. He loses the last limit to his evil. And I watched him when he cut me with his knife and when he walked away the last time. And I knew that he lost his soul. It cost him his soul, what he did. The things he did to me.
You don't have to talk about it.
No, it is okay now to talk about him. Maurizio was afraid. He was always afraid. He lived all his life in fear of everything. And he was cruel. That is what gave him his power. I have known a lot of powerful men in my life, and this much I know. All the powerful men I knew were afraid and cruel. That is the mix that gave them power over other men. I was not afraid. I was not cruel. I had no power. I was, you know, it was like the feeling for my Ulla. I was in love with Maurizio's power. And then, after he left me there, on the bed, and Ulla came into the room, I saw the fear in her eyes. He put his fear into her. He made her so afraid when she saw what he did to me that she ran away and left me there. And when I watched her leave and shut the door.
He hesitated, swallowing hard, the full unmarked lips trembling on the words. I wanted to stop him, to spare him the memory of it, and maybe save myself from it as well. But as I began to speak, he put a little more pressure in the palm that he held against my chest, silencing me, and looking up into my eyes once more.
I hated Maurizio for the first time then. My people, the people of my blood, we do not want to hate, because when we do hate, it is with the whole of the soul, and it can never forgive the hated one. But I hated Maurizio, and I wished him dead, and I cursed him with that wish. Not for what he did to me, but for what he did to my Ulla, and for what he would do in the future, as a man without a soul. So, do not worry, Lynn. I do not speak of it to anyone, what you did, and I am glad. I am truly grateful that you killed him.
A clear voice within me said that I should tell him what had really happened. He had a right to know the truth, and I wanted to tell him. An emotion that I couldn't fully understand, the last vestige of anger at Ulla, perhaps, or a jealous contempt for his faith in her, made me want to shake him and shout the truth at him and hurt him with it. But I couldn't speak. I couldn't move. And as his eyes reddened and simmered into tears that ran exactly in the channeling scars that pierced his cheeks, I held the stare and nodded my head and said nothing at all. He nodded his head slowly in reply. He misread me, I think. Or I misread him. I'll never know. Silences can wound as surely as the twisting lash, the poet Sadiq Khan once wrote. But sometimes, being silent is the only way to tell the truth. I watched Modena turn and limp away, and I knew that the wordless minute we'd shared, with his hand on my chest and his breached and weeping eyes close to mine, would always be more precious and even more honest for both of us, no matter how errable or misunderstood, than the cold, unloving truth of his world alone, or of mine. And maybe he's right, I thought. Maybe his way of remembering Maurizio and Ulla was right. Certainly, he'd dealt with the pain they'd caused him a lot better than I'd dealt with that kind of pain when it happened to me. When my marriage fell apart in betrayal and bitterness, I became a junkie. I couldn't bear it that love was broken and that happiness had cindered so suddenly into sorrow. So I ruined my life and hurt a lot of people on the long way down. Modena, instead, had worked and saved and waited for love to return. And thinking about that, how he'd lived with what had been done to him, and wondering at it on the long walk back to Abdullah and the others, I discovered something that I should have known, as Modena did right from the start. It was something simple. So simple that it took a pain as great as Modena's to shake me into seeing it. He'd been able to deal with that pain because he'd accepted his own part in causing it. I'd never accepted my share of responsibility, right up to that moment, for the way my marriage had failed, or for the heartache that had followed it. That was why I'd never dealt with it. And then, as I entered the bright, bartering bustle of the market, I did. I did accept that blame, and I felt my heart expand and unfold as it released its burdens of fear, resentment, and self-doubt. I walked back between the busy stalls, and by the time I joined Abdullah, Vikram, and the Georges, I was smiling. I answered their questions about Modena, and I thanked Abdullah for his surprise. He was right. I did forgive him everything after that. And although I couldn't find the words to tell him of the change that had happened to me, he sensed, I think, that the difference in the smile I shared with him came from a new peace that was born in me that day and slowly began to grow. The cloak of the past is cut from patches of feeling and sewn with rebus threads. Most of the time, the best we can do is wrap it around ourselves for comfort, or drag it behind us as we struggle to go on. But everything has its cause and its meaning. Every life, every love, every action and feeling and thought has its reason and significance, its beginning, and the part it plays in the end. Sometimes we do see. Sometimes we see the past so clearly and read the legend of its parts with such acuity that every stitch of time reveals its purpose and a kind of message is enfolded in it. Nothing in any life, no matter how well or poorly lived, is wiser than failure or clearer than sorrow. And in the tiny, precious wisdom that they give to us, even those dread and hated enemies, suffering and failure, have their reason and their right to be. Chapter 41. Money stinks. A stack of new money smells of ink and acid and bleach, like the fingerprinting room in a city police station. Old money, vexed with hope and coveting, smells stale like dead flowers kept too long between the pages of a cheap novel. When you put a lot of money, new and old, into one room, millions of rupees counted twice and snapped into bundles with rubber bands, it stinks. "I love money," Didier once said to me, "but I hate the smell of it. The more happiness I get from it, the more thoroughly I have to wash my hands afterwards." I knew exactly what he meant. In the counting room for the mafia money change racket, an airless cavern in the fort area, where the hot lights were bright enough to search through the best counterfeit, and the overhead fans never turned fast enough to lift a stray note from the counting tables, the smell of money was like the sweat and the dirt on a gravedigger's boots. Some weeks after the meeting with Modena, I pushed my way out through the door of Rajubai's counting room, shoving the gundas aside with the kind of childish rough play we all enjoyed, and gasped at the fresher air in the stairway. A voice called my name, and I stopped on the third step, my hand on the wooden rail. I looked up to see Rajubai leaning out of the doorway. The short, fat, bald currency controller for Salman's Mafia Council was dressed, as always, in a dhoti and a white singlet. He leaned out of the doorway, I knew, because he never actually left the room until he sealed it, at close to midnight, every night. When he needed to relieve himself, he used a private facility that was fitted with a one-way mirror so that he could watch the room. He was a dedicated accountant, the Mafia's best. But it wasn't just the duty of his profession that held Rajubai to the activity on his counting tables. Away from the busy room, he was a grumpy, suspicious, and strangely wizened man. In the counting room, he was plumper somehow, and expansively self-assured. It was as if the physical attachment linked him to a psychic force. So long as a part of his body was still in the room, he was still connected to the energy, the power, the money. "Lin Baba!" he shouted down at me, with the lower part of his body hidden by the doorframe. "Don't forget the wedding! You are coming, isn't it?" "Sure," I smiled back at him. "I'll be there." I did the quick walk-fall down three flights of the stairway, teasing and shoving the gundas on duty at every level, and bumped past the men at the street door. At the end of the street, I acknowledged the smiles of two more men watching the door. There were some exceptions, but for the most part, the young mafia gangsters liked me. I wasn't the only foreigner working with the Bombay Mafia. There was an Irish gangster in the Bandra Council, an American freelancer making a name in major drug deals, a Dutchman working with a gang in Kar, and there were other men across the city. But I was the only Gora in the Salman Council. I was their foreigner. And those years, as Indian pride was rising like new green, white and orange vines from the scorched post-colonial earth, were the last years when being foreign, being British, or looking and sounding British, was enough to win hearts and intrigue minds. Rajubai's invitation to his daughter's wedding was significant. It meant that I was accepted as one of them. For months I'd worked side by side with Salman, Sanjay, Farid, Rajubai, and others on the council. My work in the passport section was bringing in almost as much money as the entire currency operation. My own contacts on the streets threw large sums into the gold, goods and money change pots. I worked out in the boxing gym with Salman Mushtan and Abdullah Tahiri every other day. Using my friendship with Hassan Obikwa, I'd forged a new alliance with his men in the Black Ghetto. It was a useful connection, which had brought us new men, money, and markets. At Nazir's request, I'd joined the delegation that had struck an arms agreement with Afghan exiles in the city, a deal that had ensured a steady supply of weapons to the Salman Council from the semi-autonomous tribal regions on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. I had friendship and respect and more money than I cared to spend. But it wasn't until Rajubai invited me to his daughter's wedding that I knew I was truly accepted. He was a senior man on the Salman Council. His invitation was the endorsement that welcomed me into the inner circle of trust and affection. You can work with the mafia and for the mafia, and do the kind of job that earns high esteem, but you're not really one of them until they invite you home to kiss the babies. I walked out through the invisible boundaries of the fort area and approached Flora Fountain. A roving taxi slowed beside me, the driver gesturing aggressively for my fare. I waved him away. Not realizing that I could speak Hindi, he drove up beside me at a crawling pace and leaned from the window to talk.
"Hey, white sister fucker, can't you see the taxi is empty? What are you doing? Walking in the hot afternoon like somebody's lost white goat?"
"Kai pai jay tum?" I asked in rude Marathi. "What do you want?"
"Kai pai jay,"
he repeated, stunned to hear the Marathi phrase.
"What's your problem?"
I asked, speaking in the rough Marathi dialect of Bombay's back streets.
"You don't understand Marathi? This is our Bombay, and Bombay is ours. If you can't speak Marathi, what are you doing in Bombay? Have you got a goat's brain inside your sister fucking head?"
"Array," he grinned, switching to English.
"You speak Marathi, Baba."
"Gorachera Kalaman," I said in answer, making circling gestures over my face and my heart. White face, black heart. I moved into Hindi, using the most polite form of the word you to put him at ease. "I'm white on the outside, brother, but full Hindustani on the inside. I'm just taking a walk, passing time. Why don't you look for some real tourists and leave poor Indian fuckers like me alone, nah?" He laughed aloud and passed his hand across the window of his cab to shake mine gently, and then sped away. I walked on, avoiding the crowded footpaths, to join the swifter lines on the road beside the passing cars. Deep breaths of the city finally drove the smell of the currency room from my nostrils. I was heading back toward Kalaba, to Leopold's, to meet Didier. I wanted to walk because I was glad to be back in the part of the city I loved most. Work for Salman's Mafia Council took me to every distant suburb of the great city, and there were many favoured places, from Mahalakshmi to Malad, from Cotton Green to Tana, from Santa Cruz and Andheri to the Lakes District on the Film City Road. But the real seat of his council's power was in the long peninsula that began in the sweeping curve of Marine Drive and followed the Scimitar shore all the way to the World Trade Center. And it was there, in those thriving streets, never more than a few bus stops from the sea, that I'd lost my heart to the city and learned to love her. It was hot on the street, hot enough to burn all but the deepest thoughts from troubled minds. Like every other Bombayite, every other Mumbaiker, I'd made that walk from Flora Fountain to the Causeway 1,000 times. And like them, I knew where to find the cool breezes and refreshing shades on the way. My scalp, my face, and my shirt were wet with sweat in any few seconds of bare sunlight. The baptism in every daylight walk, and then cooled all the way to dry again in a minute of shaded wind. My thoughts, as I moved between the traffic and the browsing shoppers, were on the future. Paradoxically, even perversely, just as I was being accepted into the secret heart of Bombay, I also felt the strongest urge to leave. I understood the two forces, contradictory as they seemed. So much of what I'd loved about Bombay had been in the hearts and minds and words of human beings. Kala, Prabhakar, Kaderbhai, and Khaled Ansari. They were all gone, in one way or another. And yet there was a constant melancholy sense of them in every street, shrine, and strip of seacoast that I loved in the city. Still, There were new sources of love and inspiration, new beginnings rising from the fallow fields of loss and disillusion. My position with Salman's Mafia Council was secure. Business opportunities were opening up in the Bollywood film industry and the newer fields of television and multimedia. I received offers of work every other week. I had a good apartment with a view of the Haji Ali Mosque and plenty of money. And night by night, I grew a little closer in loving affection for Lisa Carter. A sadness that lingered in all my favourite places was pressing me to leave the city, just as new love and acceptance pulled me closer to her heart. And I couldn't decide, as I walked that long baptismal stretch from Flora to the causeway, which way to jump. No matter how often or deeply I thought about the struggled past or the sorrow and promise of the present, I couldn't make that leap of confidence or trust or faith into the future. There was something missing, some calculation, some piece of evidence or parallax view of my life that would make it all clear to me. I was sure, but I didn't know what it was. So I moved between the frantic flow of cars, bikes, buses, trucks and pushcarts, and the meandering progress of tourists and shoppers, and let my thoughts drift into the heat in the street.
Lin, Didier shouted, as I stepped through the wide arch and up to his long raft of joined tables. Direct from your training, no?
No, I've been walking, thinking, more of a workout for the mind, and maybe the soul.
Do not fear, he commanded, signalling for the waiter. I cure this sickness every day of every week, or every night at the least. Make a place for him, Arturo. Move down a little and let him sit next to me.
Arturo, a young Italian hiding in Bombay from an undisclosed problem with the police in Naples, was Didier's new infatuation. He was a short, slight man with a doll-like face that many a girl might have envied. He spoke very little English and reacted to every approach, no matter how friendly, with the same petulantly surly shudder of irritation. Consequently, Didier's many friends ignored him and set the alarms in their mental clocks to give the relationship from a few months at most to a few weeks before it collapsed.
You just missed Carla, Didier told me more quietly when I shook his hand. She will be upset. She wanted to...
I know, I smiled. She wanted to see me. The drinks arrived, and Didier clattered his glass against mine. I took a sip from it and put it down on the table next to him. Several people from the movie crowd that worked with Lisa Carter were at the long table, joining in a party with some of Kavita Singh's press group. Sitting next to Didier were Vikram and Letty. They were both happier and healthier than I'd ever known them to be. They bought the new apartment in the heart of Kolaba near the market only months before. While the commitment had exhausted their savings and forced them to borrow from Vikram's parents, it was proof of their faith in one another and the future of their burgeoning movie business, and they were still excited with the change. Vikram greeted me warmly, rising from his chair to give me a hug. His gunslinger's clothes had disappeared item by item, under Letty's persuasion and his own maturing taste. All that remained of the Clint Eastwood costume were the silver belt and the black cowboy boots. His beloved hat, surrendered with no little reluctance when he'd found himself more frequently in the boardrooms of major companies than in the stuntmen's corral, was hanging from a hook in my apartment. It was one of my most treasured possessions. When I leaned over to kiss Letty, she seized the shoulder of my shirt and pulled me closer to whisper in my ear.
"Keep you cool, lad," she murmured inscrutably. "Keep you cool."
Sitting next to Letty were the movie producers Cliff D'Souza and Chandra Mehta. As sometimes happens with close friends, Cliff and Chandra seemed to exchange the substance of their bodies between them over time, so that Cliff had become slightly thinner and more angular, while Chandra had gained weight in almost perfect proportion. The more they differed physically, however, the more they resembled one another in other ways. In fact, the close colleagues, who often worked and played together for 40 hours at a stretch, used so many of the same gestures, facial expressions and phrases that they were known on the sets of the movies they produced as Fat Uncle and Skinny Uncle. They raised their arms in identically enthusiastic greeting when I approached them, although each was pleased to see me for his own reasons. Cliff D'Souza had developed a passionate affection for Kavita Singh since I'd introduced them, and he'd hoped I might influence her in his favour. Having a far longer acquaintance with her, I knew that no power could influence Kavita toward anything not fully consonant with her will and her wish. Still, she seemed to like him well enough, and they had much in common. They were both almost 30 and unmarried, a status so unusual in the Indian upper middle class in those years that their families anguished over it at every feast and festival in the crowded calendar. They were both media professionals who prided themselves on their independence and artistic flair. They were also driven by the same instinctive tolerance to seek out and fairly examine each point of view in any apparent conflict of interests. And they were attractive people. Kavita's shapely figure and perilously seductive eye seemed the perfect complement to Cliff's rangy angularity and the boyishness of his artless, lopsided grin. For my part, liking them both, I saw no reason to resist the matchmaker's urge to meddle. In public, I made it clear that I liked Cliff D'Souza, and in private, I praised him discreetly to her whenever the natural opportunity arose. They had a chance, a good chance, it seemed to me, and my heart put a wishing star in my eyes for them. Chandra Mehta, on the other hand, was pleased to see me because I was his closest link to the black money in Salman's mafia council, and the only link he could describe as amicable. Like Kader before him, Salman Mushtaan saw great advantage in the access to Bombay's film world that Chandra Mehta provided. New regulations at federal and state levels had tightened restrictions on the flow of capital, making it ever more difficult to launder black money. For many reasons, not least because of the irresistible glamour attached to the industry, politicians had exempted the movie business from many of those monetary and investment controls. They were boom economy years, and Bollywood films were going through a renaissance in style and confidence. The films got bigger and better, and had begun to reach out to a wider world market. As the budgets for successful films soared, however, producers exhausted the traditional sources of revenue. That convergence of interests drove more than a few producers and production houses into strange syzygies with gangsters. Films about mafia gundas were financed by the mafia, and the profits from hit movies about hit men went into new crimes and real hits on real people, which in turn became the subjects for screenplays and new films, financed by more mafia money. And I played my part, so to speak, by working as the connection between Chandra Mehta and Salman Mushtaan. The relationship was a lucrative one. The Salman Council had put crores, each crore being 10 million rupees, through Mehta D'Souza Productions, and drew clean, untraceable profits from the bottom line. That first contact with Chandra Mehta, when he'd asked me to find a few thousand American dollars on the black market, had fattened into a nexus that the portly producer couldn't resist or refuse. He was rich and getting richer. But the men who poured their wealth into his company frightened him, and every contact with them was menaced with the scent of their distrust. So Chandra Mehta smiled at me and was glad to see me, and tried to pull me tighter into the tremulous clutch of his friendship whenever our paths crossed. I didn't mind. I liked Chandra Mehta, and I liked Bollywood movies. I allowed him to drag me into the worried, wealthy world of his friendship. Next to him at the table was Lisa Carter. Her thick blonde hair had grown long enough, after the short cut, to fall beside the oval cameo of her face. Her blue eyes were clear and glittering with passionate intent. She was tanned and very healthy. She'd even gained a little extra weight, something she decried, but that I and every other man within her sight horizon was bound to admire. And there was something new and very different in her manner, a warm, unhurried softness in her smile, a willing laugh that won the laughter of others, and a lightness of spirit that looked for and often found the best in those she met. For weeks, months, I'd watched those changes shift and settle in her, and at first I'd thought they'd grown from my affection. Although no formal relationship had been declared, she continued to live in her apartment and I lived in mine. We were lovers, and we were far more than friends. After a time, I realized that the changes were not mine, but hers alone. After a time, I began to see how deep the well of her loving was, and how much her happiness and confidence depended on drawing that love into the light and sharing it. And love was beautiful in her. It was a clear sky she gave us with those eyes, and a summer morning with her smile. She kissed my cheek when I greeted her. I returned the kiss, wondering as I stepped back why a small concerned frown rippled from her brow to her cornflower blue eyes. Sitting next around the long table were the print journalists Dilip and Anwar. They were young, only a few years out of college, and still learning their trade in the anonymous vaults of The Noonday, a Bombay daily. At night, with Didier and his little court, they discussed the big breaking stories of the day, as if they'd played key parts in the scoops or had followed their own instincts to the investigation's end. Their excitement, enthusiasm, ambition, and limitless hope for the future so delighted everyone in the Leopold's crowd that Kavita and Didier felt obliged to respond, occasionally, with sardonic sniping. Dilip and Anwar reacted well, laughing and often giving as good as they got, until the whole group was shouting and pounding the table in delight. Dilip was a tall, fair, almond-eyed Punjabi. Anwar, a third-generation native of Bombay, was shorter, darker, and the more serious of the two. "New blood," Letty had said to me with a smile, a few days before that afternoon. It was a phrase she'd once used about me, soon after I'd arrived in Bombay. And as I made my way around the table and looked at the two young men talking with such passion and purpose, it occurred to me that once, before heroin and crime, my life had been like theirs. Once I'd been just as happy and healthy and hopeful as they were. And I was glad to know them, and to know they were a part of the pleasure and promise of the Leopold's crowd. It was right that they were there, just as it was right that Maurizio was gone, and Ulla and Modena were gone, and that I too would one day be gone. Returning their warm handshakes, I moved past the young men to Kavita Singh sitting beside them. Kavita stood to give me a hug. It was the tender, close hug that a woman gives a man when she knows she can trust him, or when she's sure his heart belongs to someone else. It was a rare enough embrace between foreigners. Coming from an Indian woman, it was uniquely intimate in my experience. And it was important. I'd been in the city for years. I could make myself understood in Marathi, Hindi, and Urdu. I could sit with gangsters, slum dwellers, or Bollywood actors, claiming their goodwill and sometimes their respect. But few things made me feel as accepted, in all the Indian worlds of Bombay, as Kavita Singh's fond embrace. I never told her that, what her affectionate and unconditional acceptance meant to me. So much, too much, of the good that I felt in those years of exile was locked in the prison cell of my heart. Those tall walls of fear, that small barred window of hope, that hard bed of shame. I do speak out now. I know now that when the loving, honest moment comes, it should be seized and spoken, because it may never come again. And unvoiced, unmoving, unlived in the things we declare from heart to heart, those true and real feelings wither and crumble in the remembering hand that tries too late to reach for them. On that day, as the grey-pink veil of evening slowly enclosed the afternoon, I said nothing to Kavita. I let my smile, like a thing made of broken stones, fall and slide from the peak of her affection to the ground beneath her feet. She took my arm and steered me into an introduction to the man who sat beside her. "Lynn, I don't think you've met Ranjit," she said, as he stood and we shook hands. "Ranjit is Carla's friend. Ranjit Chowdhury, meet Lynn." I suddenly knew what Letty had meant with her cryptic comment, "Keep your cool, lad," and why Lisa couldn't shift the frown that creased her brow.
Call me Jeet, he offered. His smile was wide, natural and confident.
Okay, I answered evenly, not really smiling. Pleased to meet you, Jeet.
And it's a pleasure to meet you, he countered,
with the well-rounded and musical inflection of Bombay's best private schools and universities. My favourite accent, in all the beautiful ways to speak the English language.
I've heard so much about you.
Acha, I responded without thinking, exactly as an Indian of my age might have done. The word in its literal translation means good. In that context, and with that inflection, it meant, oh yeah.
Yes, he laughed, releasing my hand. Carla talks about you often. You're quite the hero to her, I'm sure you know.
That's funny, I answered, not sure if he was as ingenuous as he seemed to be. She once told me that heroes only come in three kinds, dead, damaged, or dubious. He tipped his head back and roared with laughter, his mouth open wide enough to reveal a perfect set of perfect Indian teeth. Still laughing, he met my eye and wagged his head in wonder. So that's part of it, I thought. He gets her jokes. He likes her play with words. He understands her love of them and her cleverness. That's one of the reasons why she likes him. Okay. The rest of it was more obvious. He had a lithe build and was average tall, my height, with an open, handsome face. More than just the sum of good features. High cheekbones, a high, wide forehead, expressive topaz-coloured eyes, a strong nose, smiling mouth, and firm chin. It was the kind of face that once would have been called dashing. The lone yachtsman, the mountaineer, the jungle adventurer. He wore his hair short. The hairline was receding, but even that seemed to suit him, as if it was the preferred option for healthy, athletic men. And the clothes. I knew them well from the shopping expeditions that Sanjay, Andrew, Faisal, and the other mafiosi made to the most expensive stores in the city. There wasn't a self-respecting gangster in Bombay who wouldn't have pursed his lips and wagged his head in approval of Ranjit's clothes. Well, I said, shuffling my feet to move around him and greet Kalpana, the last friend sitting in the loop of the table. She was working as a first assistant director for Mater D'Souza Productions, and in training to become a director in her own right. She looked up at me and winked.
Wait, Ranjit requested, softly but quickly. I wanted to tell you about your stories. Your short stories?
I turned to flinch a frown at Kavita Singh, who hunched her shoulders and raised the palms of her hands as she looked away.
Kavita let me read them, and I wanted to tell you how good they are. I mean, how good I think they are.
Well, thanks, I muttered, trying once again to move past him.
Really? I read them all, and I think they're really great.
There are few things more discomforting than a spontaneous outburst of genuine decency from someone you're determined to dislike for no good reason. I felt a little blush of shame beginning to spread across my cheeks. Thanks, I said, putting truth into my eyes and my voice for the first time. It's damn nice to hear, even if Kavita wasn't supposed to show them to anyone.
I know she wasn't, he said quickly, but I think you should. Show them to someone, I mean. They're not right for my paper. It's not the right forum, but the Noonday, well, it would be the perfect forum for them. And I know they'd buy them for a very fair price. The editor of the Noonday, Anil, is a friend of mine. I know what he likes, and I know he'll like your stories. I didn't show him your work, of course, not without your permission. But I did tell him that I read them, and that I think they're good. He wants to meet you. If you take your stories to him, I'm sure you'll get on well with him. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. He's hoping to see you, but it's up to you. Whatever you decide, I wish you all the best.
He sat down, and I moved past him to greet Kalpana and then take my place beside Didier. I was so distracted by the exchange with Ranjit, Jeet Chowdhury, that I only half listened to Didier's announcement of his planned trip to Italy with Arturo. 3 months, I heard him say,
and I remember thinking that 3 months in Italy could become 3 years, and that I might lose him. The thought was so strange that I wouldn't let myself consider it. Bombay without Didier was like Bombay without Leopold's, or the Haji Ali Mosque, or the Gateway Monument. It was unthinkable. Pushing the thought away, I looked around the laughing, drinking, talking table of friends, and filled the empty glass within me, pouring their successes and their hopes into my eyes. Then I returned my attention to Ranjit, Carla's boyfriend. I'd done my homework on him in recent months. I knew that he was the second eldest, some said the favourite, of four sons born to Ramprakash Chowdhury, a truck driver who'd made his fortune resupplying coastal towns in Bangladesh that had been hit by cyclones. The first government tenders had grown into major contracts, requiring fleets of trucks and eventually chartered aircraft and ships. Along the way, Chowdhury had acquired a small circulation Bombay newspaper as part of a merger with a more diversified transport and communications firm. He'd handed the paper to his son, Ranjit, who'd just graduated with a business degree and was the first on both sides of his family to complete high school and to attend any kind of further education college. Ranjit had been running the paper, rebadged as the Daily Post, for 8 years. His success with the Post, as it was known, had allowed Ranjit to segue into the incipient field of independent television production. He was wealthy, influential, popular, and possessed of an entrepreneurial elan in print, movies, and television, a media baron in the making. There were rumours of resentment stirring in the heart of Ranjit's older brother, Rahul, who'd joined his father in the transport business in his early teenage years, and had never enjoyed the private school education lavished upon Ranjit and the younger siblings. There was gossip also about the two younger brothers, the wild parties they sometimes threw, and the large bribes required to keep them out of trouble. There was no criticism of Ranjit, however, in any connection. And apart from those few simmering concerns, his life seemed almost charmed. He was, as Letty had once said, quite a fat and shiny catch. And as I watched him with friends, listening more than he talked, smiling more than he frowned, self-deprecating and considerate, tactful and attentive, I had to admit to myself that he was a very likable man. And strangely, I felt sorry for him. A few years or even months before, I would have been jealous that he was such a likable man. Such a very nice guy, as more than a few people said to me when I'd asked them about him. I would have hated him. But I felt nothing like that for Ranjit Chowdhury. Instead, as I watched him, remembering too much of what I'd felt for Carla, and thinking about her clearly for the first time in a long time, I felt sorry for the rich, handsome media baron, and I wished him luck. For half an hour, I talked across the table with Lisa and the others, and then I looked up to see Johnny Cigar standing in the wide doorway and gesturing to catch my eye. Delighted to have an excuse to leave, I turned to Didier and drew him around to face me. "Listen, if you're really serious about going to Italy for 3 months..."
"Certainly I am," he began, but I cut him off quickly.
"And if you're really serious about needing someone to look after your place for you while you're away, I think I've got just the guys for the job."
"Oh, yes? And who are they?"
"The Georges," I replied. "The Zodiac Georges, Gemini and Scorpio." Didier was appalled.
"But these Georges people, they are, how can I say it?"
"Reliable," I suggested. "Honest, clean, loyal, brave. And above all, the most important qualification for situations like this, they're absolutely not interested in staying in your apartment for a minute longer than you want them to. In fact, I'll have a damn hard job talking them into it in the first place. They like the street. They won't want to do it. But if I let them know they're doing me a favour, they might agree. They'll do a good job of looking after your place for you, and they'll get 3 months of safe living in a decent place."
"Decent?" Didier scoffed. "What do you mean, decent? My apartment is without parallel in Bombay, Lynn. You know that. Excellent, I can understand. Superb, I can accept. but decent, no. It is like saying that I live in the fish market and, what do you say, whoosh it out every day with a water hose.
So, what do you think? I've got to go.
Decent,
he sniffed. Come on, man, will you forget about that?
Well, yes, perhaps you are right. I have nothing against them. The George from Canada, the Scorpio, he does speak some French. That is true. Yes, yes, tell them I think it is a good idea. Tell them to see me and I will speak to them, with very careful instructions.
Laughing as I said goodbye, I joined Johnny Cigar at the doorway of the restaurant. He pulled me close to him.
Can you come with me?
No, he asked. Sure. Walking or taxi?
I think taxi, Lin.
We pushed our way through the breaking waves of walkers to the road and found a taxi. I was smiling as we waved the taxi down and climbed inside. For months I'd been trying to find a way to help Gemini and Scorpio George that was more meaningful than the money I gave them from time to time. Didier's holiday with Arturo provided the perfect opportunity. I knew that 3 months in Didier's apartment would add years to their lives. 3 months without the stress of street living and with the secure good health that only a home and home cooking can provide. And I also knew that with the Zodiac Georges in his apartment while he was gone, Didier would worry just enough to make his return to Bombay a little more likely and a little sooner.
Where to? I asked Johnny.
World Trade Center, he told the driver,
smiling at me but clearly concerned about something.
What's up? There is a problem at the Jopalpati, he answered me.
Okay, I said, knowing that he wouldn't say anything else about the problem until he thought the moment was right. How's the baby?
Fine, very fine, he laughed. He has such a strong grab on my fingers. He will be big and strong, bigger than his father, sure. And Prabhaka's baby, from the sister of my Sita Parvati, that baby is also very beautiful. He is very much like Prabhaka, in his face and his smiling.
I didn't want to think about my dead beloved friend.
And how's Sita and the girls? I asked.
They're fine, Lin, all fine.
You'll have to watch out, Johnny, I warned him. 3 kids in less than 3 years. Before you know it, you'll be a fat old guy with 9 kids climbing all around you.
It is a fine dream, he sighed happily.
How's work? How are you doing for money?
Also fine, very fine, Lin. Everybody pays taxes and nobody likes it. My business is good. Sita and me, we decided to buy the house next to ours and make a bigger house for the family.
That's fantastic. I can't wait to see it.
There was a little silence, and then Johnny turned to me with an expression of worry, almost of torment.
Lin, that time when you asked me to work for you, to work with you, and I refused.
It's okay, Johnny.
No, it is not okay. I want to tell you, I should have said yes, and I should have worked beside you.
Are you in trouble? I asked, not understanding him. Is business not as good as you said it was? Do you need money?
No, no, everything is fine with me. But if I was with you that time, watching you, maybe you would not still be working for all these months at the black business with those gundas.
No, Johnny.
I blame myself every day, Lin, he said,
his lips pulled wide in an anguished grimace.
I think that you asked me to work with you, to be your friend, because you did need a friend at that time. I was a bad friend, Lin, and I blame myself. Every day I feel bad about it. I'm so sorry that I refused you.
I put my hand on his shoulder, but he wouldn't meet my eye. Look, Johnny, you've got to understand. What I do, I don't feel good about it, but I don't feel bad about it either. You do feel bad about it, and I respect that. I admire it. And you're a good friend.
No,
he murmured, his eyes still downcast.
Yes, I insisted. I love you, man.
Lin,
he said, grabbing my arm with sudden urgent concern.
Please, please be careful with these gundas, please.